to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 148, Some True History, Part 4. Once again, reading from Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's An Indigenous People's History of the United States. A couple of listeners said how much they think and feel this book is a very important book. So thanks for the comments. Chapter 9, the U.S. Triumphalism and Peacetime Colonialism. The late 1800s into the 1900s. Setting the scene for much of what's unfolded since then and into nowadays. And then the next chapter, Ghost Dance Prophecy, getting much farther up to some names and events that most people are familiar with. Looks like part 5 may wrap it up. There's a chapter on the doctrine of Christian discovery, and then the conclusion. So, seeing how much those very significant aspects time will take will determine 5 or 6 parts. And so, much to learn from the past to help us appreciate and be true to the present and see how to prove and project some positive changes into the future. This is your host, Monk. Thanks for listening. Outside again, starting chapter 9, U.S. Triumphalism and Peacetime Colonialism. Although U.S. imperialism abroad might seem at first to fall outside the scope of this book, it's important to recognize that the same methods and strategies that were employed with the indigenous peoples on the continent were mirrored abroad. While the indigenous Americans were being brutally colonized, eliminated, relocated, and killed, the U.S. from its beginning was also pursuing overseas dominance. Between 1798 and 1827, the U.S. intervened militarily 23 times, from Cuba to Tripoli, parentheses Libya, and to Greece. There were 71 overseas interventions between 1831 and 96 on all continents, and the U.S. dominated most of Latin America economically, some countries militarily. The 40 interventions and occupations between 1898 and 1919 were conducted with even more military heft, but using the same methods and sometimes the same personnel. So there are quotes going back to Washington, first president, calling it an empire, and other people calling it an empire, and so hence the U.S. Empire, acronym USE, because it uses people and stuff. And again, why this book is so important. Many people are justifiably shocked about what's going on with America today, but when you know you see the history, you see how a lot of it was already ingrained. And she cites various people who proponents of transoceanic imperialism, former abolitionist William Seward, who was Lincoln's Secretary of State and considered the destiny of the U.S. to dominate the Pacific Ocean. The Reverend Josiah Strong of the American Home Missionary Society argued that the U.S. had inherited the mantle of Anglo-Saxonism and, as a superior race, had a divine responsibility to control the world. And here we are, as you're mentioning, 1898-ish time. It took the United States 3 more years to crush the Filipino Indian resistance to U.S. occupation. The army, using counterinsurgency techniques practiced against the indigenous nations of the North American continent, including new forms of torture such as waterboarding and under many of the same army commanders. The continuity between invading and occupying sovereign indigenous nations in order to achieve continental control in North America and employing the same tactics overseas to achieve global control is key to understanding the future of the U.S. in the world. The military provided that continuity. As a colonel in the 1870s, Nelson Miles had been in charge of pursuing every last Sioux and herding them onto reservations guarded by troops or recently trained Indian police. Skipping along this chapter, by this time Theodore Roosevelt was president. His corporate-friendly militarism, particularly his rapid development of the Navy and his carefully staged performance as leader of the Rough Riders militia in Cuba, brought him to the presidency. He was popular with both settlers and big business. 200,000 U.S. soldiers fought in the Philippines, suffering 7,000 casualties. 20% of the Philippine population died, mostly civilians, as a result of the U.S. Army's scorched earth strategy. Food deprivation, targeting civilians for killing and so on, and displacement. In 1904, Roosevelt pronounced what has come to be known as the Roosevelt Corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. It mandated that any nation engaged in, quote, chronic wrongdoing, end quote, that is, did anything to threaten perceived U.S. economic or political interests, would be disciplined militarily by the U.S., which was to serve as an international police power. As the U.S. economy rapidly industrialized, the Army also intervened frequently on the side of big business in domestic conflicts between corporations and workers. Troops were used for this purpose in the Great Railroad Strike of 1877, the first nationwide work stoppage begun by railroad workers protesting wage cuts. Sound familiar? Industrialization affected farming. As machinery replaced farmers' hands and cash crops came to prevail, large operators moved in and banks foreclosed on small farmers, leaving them landless. Farmers' movements, most of them socialist-leaning and anti-imperialist, opposed military conscription and U.S. entry into World War I, the rich man's war, as they called it. Tens of thousands protested and carried out acts of civil disobedience. In August 1917, white, black, and Muskogee tenant farmers and sharecroppers in several eastern and southern Oklahoma counties took up arms to stop conscription, with a larger stated goal of overthrowing the U.S. government to establish a socialist commonwealth. The rebellion, I think there's the Green Corn Rebellion, considered as the waning voice of the people pushed off the land, but it also reflects the crisis induced by the forced allotment of indigenous territories and the reality of a multi-ethnic resistance movement, a rare occurrence in U.S. colonialist history. She goes on to cite Pancho Villa in Mexico. There's a section called Markets Kill. The extension of U.S. military power in the Pacific and Caribbean was not militarism for its own sake. Rather, it was all about securing markets and natural resources, developing imperialist power to protect and extend corporate wealth. Somebody named Miner. Historian Craig Miner argues that industrial civilization diminishes the relevance of persons or communities in its way, and also notes that industrial civilization is not exactly the same as industrialization, that is, that it is something quite different and more pervasive. Industrial civilization justified exploitation and destruction of whole societies and expansion without regard for the sovereignty of peoples. It promoted individualism, competition, and selfishness as righteous character traits. The means by which the U.S. government assured corporate freedom to intrude in indigenous territories was federal trusteeship, the very instrument that was mandated to protect them. So John Trudell mentioned the IRC, the industrial ruling class. There's a Cherokee official noting the American businessman in that industry habit and energy of character, which is the result of the development of the idea of accumulation. Entering the 1920s, indigenous peoples were at their lowest point, both in population and possibility for survival after decades of violent military operations during and following the Civil War, along with federal theft of indigenous treaty guaranteed funds and then 2 decades of allotment and indigenous lands. Then the U.S. government imposed unsolicited citizenship on American Indians with the Indian Citizen Act of 1924, gesturing toward assimilation and dissolving the nations. Congress passed the 1924 Pueblo Lands Act. Having lived at Taos Pueblo, whose residents practiced traditional life ways, Collier had developed respect for the communal social relations he observed in indigenous communities and had confidence that these people could govern themselves successfully and even influence a move towards socialism in the U.S. He understood and agreed with indigenous opposition to assimilation as individuals into the general society, but the ongoing allotment in severalty of native collective states and the Indian Citizenship Act of 1924 sought to institutionalize. And talking about the Boulder Dam and that Navajo Reservation, his action was influenced by agribusiness that wanted to get rid of all small producers in order to create an advantage to Anglo settler ranchers in New Mexico and Arizona. The process is still bitterly remembered by Navajos, with traumatized Navajos watching government agents shot sheep and goats and left them to rot or cremated them after dousing them with gasoline. At one site alone, 35 goats were shot and left to rot. 150,000 goats and 50,000 sheep were killed in this manner. Oral history interviews tell of the pressure tactics on the Navajos, including arrests of those who resisted and expressed bitterness over the destruction of their livestock. As Navajo Council member Howard Gorman said, all of these incidents broke a lot of hearts of the Navajo people and left them mourning for years. They didn't like it that the sheep were killed. It was a total waste. This is what the people said. To many of them, livestock was a necessity and meant survival. Some people consider livestock as sacred because it is life's necessity. They think of livestock as their mother. The cruel way our stock was handled is something that should never have happened. So you have the buffalo slaughterings in the plains, and that's more well known. This I had not heard of, the sheep and goats in the Navajo. And further on in the book, there's a mention of dogs. Trying to remember the context, but anyway, it all sounds horrific, and it is, but at least trying to understand it, it is, from the ones who are not connected with the consciousness of all the relations. And then there was the 1956 Indian Relocation Act. With BIA funding, any indigenous individual or family could relocate to designated urban industrial areas. San Francisco, Los Angeles, Phoenix, Dallas, Denver, Cleveland, where BIA offices were established to make housing and job training and placement available. So, maybe nice for some, and it's sort of started the modern era of, I think, something like 50% of Native people now do not even live on the reservations, but are in amidst the country. But the assimilative process, and the series I did a while ago, still haven't finished it, actually. I had a couple of chapters left. The Mary Jo Moore's anthology, Genocide of the Mind, was one of the first books that really showed me the modern, the modern plight and the better understanding of the Native in modern today's world as living off reservation or sometimes on and off, and that whole process, and also the mixed breedness as more people travel and intermingle, there's more mixed breeding, so that as things evolve, they change. And then this influx, similar to how I've heard of Chinese peasants being, you know, sort of drawn into cities. But then in the 50s and 60s began the intertribal movements organized around the urban American Indian centers. In one of the largest of the relocation destinations, San Francisco Bay Area, this would culminate in the 18th month occupation of Alcatraz in the late 60s. And that was perhaps one of the first events that made John Trudell more prominent. And he was, you know, one of the key spokespersons. In wrapping up this chapter, the whole issue of borders is still an issue. The wars against Japan and then Korea, along with the successful Chinese Communist Revolution, revived the early 20th century racist fear of a yellow peril. Mexican migrant workers largely replaced the Asian agricultural workers displaced by the Japanese American internment. But it's just like whatever minority is available seems to be the mode. But in 1953, Operation Wetback, as the federal program was called, forced the deportation of more than 1 million Mexican workers, in the process subjugating millions of U.S. citizens of Mexican heritage to illegal search and arrest. Native Americans continued to experience brutality, including rape and detention in the border towns on the edges of reservation lands and at the hands of citizens as well as law enforcement officials. And let's see, wrapping up this chapter, couple of paragraphs. As national liberation movements surged in European colonies in Africa and Asia, the U.S. responded with counterinsurgency. The U.S. CIA was formed in 1947. Interestingly, I just read an article online about the National Security Council at that time as well, and expanded in size and global reach during the Eisenhower administration under Director Alan Dulles, brother of Eisenhower's Secretary of State John Foster Dulles. The CIA instrumentalized the overthrow of the democratically elected governments of Iran in 53 and Guatemala in 54. Guatemala had been the leading light in developing the Inter-American Indian Institute, a 1940 treaty-based initiative that Dave Warren and Darcy McNichol were involved with. Following the coup, the Institute headquarters relocated from Guatemala City to Mexico City. But there it no longer had the same clout. Covert action came to be the primary means of counterinsurgency, while military invasion remained an option, as in Vietnam, following a decade of covert counterinsurgency there. In the build-up to the U.S. war in Vietnam, the CIA set the stage with its, quote, secret war, end quote, in Laos, organizing the indigenous Hmong, H-M-O-N-G, as a CIA-sponsored army. After Iran and Guatemala, the CIA engineered coups in Indonesia, the Congo, Greece, and Chile, while attempting assassinations of coups that failed in Cuba, Iraq, Laos, and other countries. Interesting there, shows how Iraq was on the charts for a while. And she wraps up with Kennedy and the Bay of Pigs and CIA trying to assassinate Kid Castro. And she wraps up that chapter with the revolution in Cuba, just 90 miles off the Florida coast, would be a touchstone for increasingly radicalized young people in the U.S., but even more so for the indigenous peoples of Latin America, which resonated with Native American activists seeking self-determination to their north. So that shows a really key, in recent learnings about Latin America, I've seen how much, Cuba is respected. And so here, learning that how much Cuba's influence in their independence back in 1959 with Castro, how that helped create this still today wave of community, solidarity, socialism, whatever you want to call it, to the South and the North. And chapter 10, Ghost Dance Prophecy, A Nation is Coming. 70 years after the Wounded Knee Massacre, when the conquest of the continent was said to have been complete and with Hawaii and Alaska made into states, the myth of an exceptional U.S.-American people destined to bring order out of chaos, to stimulate economic growth, and to replace savagery with civilization, not just in North America but throughout the world, proved to have enormous staying power. A key to JFK's political success was that he revived the, quote, frontier, end quote, as a trope of populist imperialism openly based on the drama and popular myth of settling the continent, of taming a different sort of wilderness. He asked his audience to see him as a new kind of frontiersman confronting a different sort of wilderness. This is JFK in 1960 Democratic Convention. I stand tonight facing west on what was once the last frontier. From the lands that stretched 3,000 miles behind me, the pioneers of old gave up their safety, their comfort, and sometimes their lives to build a new world here in the west. We stand today on the edge of a new frontier, a frontier of unknown opportunities and paths, a frontier of unfulfilled hopes and threats. So again, this is like the jargon and the storylines that get propagandized. I mean, there are things I like about Bernie Sanders, but I saw him on the Nightly Show, comedy show, and it was a rather, you know, some jokes, but there was a seriousness to the interview. But, you know, he's mentioning New York and my state and my this and him being a son of immigrants and, you know, the general. I mean, he has had some connection with natives. I think his wife visited the Navajo. But anyway, the general storyline, though, is to not mention the natives and to not mention the imperial bent of the empire. So there that is. Let's see. In 1894, historian Frederick Jackson Turner had presented his history-making frontier thesis, claiming that the crisis of that era was the result of the closing of the frontier and that a new frontier was needed to fill the ideological and spiritual vacuum created by the completion of settler colonialism. And then further on, 7 years after Kennedy's nomination, Slotkin reminded us American troops would be describing Vietnam as Indian country and search and destroy missions as a game of cowboys and Indians. And Kennedy's ambassador to Vietnam would justify a massive military escalation by citing the necessity of moving the Indians away from the fort so that the settlers could plant corn. And let's see, 1961, something called the National Indian Youth Council starts to get into some of the organizations that I think have helped the native peoples. And here's a quote from a Yakima and Cherokee Indian who served in the army in Vietnam, and the end of the quote says, "What kind of government or society would spend millions of dollars to pick upon our bones, restore our ancestral life patterns, and protect our ancient remains from damage, while at the same time eating upon the flesh of our living people?" In 1964 Civil Rights Act, inter-ethnic alliances, including a significant representation of Native peoples, developed during the mid-60s, and local actions multiplied in Native communities, and nations, the spectacular November 69 seizure, an 18-month occupation of Alcatraz Island in San Francisco, an alliance known as the Indians of All Tribes. And that was, here she has a, they presented their proclamation of the Indians of All Tribes, attained with joyful good humor. "We, the Native Americans, reclaim the land known as Alcatraz Island in the name of all American Indians by right of discovery. We wish to be fair and honorable in our dealings with the Caucasian inhabitants of this land and hereby offer the following treaty. We will purchase said Alcatraz Island for $24 in glass beads and red cloth, a precedent set by the white man's purchase of a similar island about 300 years ago. We will give to the inhabitants of this island a portion of the land for their own to be held in trust by the American Indians government and by the Bureau of Caucasian Affairs to hold in perpetuity for as long as the sun shall rise and the rivers go down to the sea. We will further guide the inhabitants in the proper way of living. We will offer them our religion, our education, our life ways in order to help them achieve our level of civilization and thus raise them and all their white brothers up from their savage and unhappy state. Further, it would be fitting and symbolic that ships from all over the world entering the Golden Gate would first see Indian land, and thus be reminded of the true history of this nation. This tiny island would be a symbol of the great lands once ruled by free and noble Indians." So, I think she goes on to say they made serious demands. Institutions were established: Center for Native American Studies, American Indian Spiritual Center, Indian Center of Ecology. And it gets into the colleges, 2-year Native American Chicano College and Movement Center. Deccanawita Quetzalcoatl University was founded while UC Davis became the first university to offer a doctorate in Native American studies. During this period of intense protest and activism, alliances among indigenous governments, including the National Congress of American Indians, led by Young Sioux attorney Vine Deloria Jr., turned militant demands into legislation. A year before the seizure of Alcatraz, Ojibwe activists Dennis Banks and Clyde Bellancourt founded the American Indian Movement. And she goes on towards the end of the book to show how the how significant Vine Deloria Jr.'s work is, and the using of the legal system and the treaties as one of the key ways for natives to deal with colonialism. And then on it goes, mentioning what becomes the basis of the 2007 UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Delegation sent by AIM leaders, led by Russell Means. This gets into the Wounded Knee of 1973, the Siege of Wounded Knee. The period between the closing of the frontier, marked by the 1890 Wounded Knee Massacre, and the 1973 Siege of Wounded Knee, which marks the beginning of indigenous decolonization in North America, is illuminated by the following historical experience of the Sioux. It goes on to show the treaties that didn't really do much: the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1851, followed by a decade of war, ending with the Peace Treaty of Fort Laramie 1868. Then the gold was found. On the plains, the Sioux gradually abandoned farming and turned entirely to bison hunting for their subsistence and for trade. The increased dependency on the buffalo in turn brought deeper dependency on guns and ammunition that had to be purchased with more hides, creating the vicious cycle that characterized modern colonialism. Effects of the fur trade, etc., etc. Nevertheless, in 1876, with no such validation with the discovery of gold by Custer's 7th Cavalry, the U.S. government seized the Black Hills. Pahasapa, a large resource-rich portion of the 20 treaty-guaranteed Sioux territory, the center of the Great Sioux Nation, a religious shrine and sanctuary. And this is where, as in Marshall's book about Crazy Horse, gets into the Sioux becoming, says unarmed, had no horses, unable to feed and clothe themselves, dependent on government rations. In the allotment, now here's a key thing which shows the essence of why sacred sites are so important. The Gray Sioux Nation was broken into small islands, soon surrounded on all sides by European immigrants, with much of the reservation land a checkerboard with settlers on allotments or leased land. Creating these isolated reservations broke the historical relationships between clans and communities of the Sioux Nations and opened up where Europeans settled. It also allowed the BIA to exercise tighter control, along with the boarding school system. The Sundance annual ceremony that had brought Sioux people together and reinforced national unity was outlawed, along with religious ceremonies. So that became legalized. But is there or another place where she cites, the actual access to sacred sites and lands where ceremony are done, as the disconnect from that affecting the people in creating a distance from their traditions, and so it's like slowly weaning them from what is the essence. And this has been written about over years, with Hopis talking about the insignificance of their land, and that that what happens there has ramifications to the balance of the entire planet. So that was recently an article on Censored News, years ago, them saying that. And so, but yet, when the mining and extractivism goes on, it has these wider effects that affect the balance of that we have with Mother Earth. So that's in some way what's playing out now. I remember reading about that in a book about the uranium as an attractor for lightning. So uranium taken out of the land is, in that regard, in a relativity way, affecting lightning, and thus rain, and thus affecting crops and the whole cycles. And these are things that, this is one of those things that indigenous people, native peoples, just seem just know way more about. And here's a section, a statement here. The logical progression of modern colonialism begins with economic penetration and graduates to a sphere of influence, then to protectorate status or indirect control, military occupation, and finally annexation. And then she's describing what happened to the, you know, Sioux, the Lakota, back then. And then, so this, you know, this book, very, you could be in any part of the world and you could learn from this book, because the blueprint, as she shows various counterinsurgency tactics, this colonialism tactics, and since this has now been exported, you know, people, countries can learn what the F goes on and what's trying to be stopped. That's their next section, Indian Wars as a Template for the U.S. in the World. There's a significant book, which I have, but I've only glimpsed at, D. Brown, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. And that book helped. By the time the Wounded Knee in 73, the siege happened, that was very much on the map and making the mainstream news. The statement, the Iraq War was just another Indian war in the U.S. military tradition. Here's an interesting connecting. After weeks of high-tech bombing in Iraq, followed by a caravan of armored tanks shooting everything that moved, the U.S. Special Forces entered Iraqi office quarters in Kuwait City. There they found carrier pigeons in cages and notes in Arabic strewn over desks, which they interpreted to mean that the Iraqi commanders were communicating with their troops and even with Baghdad using carrier pigeons. High-tech soldiers had been fighting an army that communicated by carrier pigeon, as Shawnees and Muscogees had done two centuries earlier. So much in here I'd like to do more of, but just trying to get the essences of the. A lot of it is easily researchable. If you know, you look up the some of the history of Wounded Knee and the Fort Laramie Treaty. And then she interestingly connects April 2007. There was, I think it was the Virginia School, Virginia Tech University shootings, and she mentions that no one commented in the media about Jamestown was famously the first permanent settlement. Jamestown was famously the first permanent settlement that gave birth to the Commonwealth of Virginia. Plymouth was a few years after Jamestown. Plymouth was planted by English religious dissidents under the auspices of private investors with royal approval, as with Jamestown, and the same mercenary activities personified by Captain John Smith. This was the beginning of British overseas colonialism after the conquest and colonization of Scotland, Wales, and Ireland turned England into Great Britain. Again, the theofascism, religious dissidents, private investors, royal approval. There you have the recipe for theofascism. And also, I learned, wasn't quite sure the difference between Great Britain and England until I read this book and realized that Great Britain came from the conquest and colonization of Scotland, Wales, and Ireland. The Virginia Tech killings described as the worst mass killing, the worst massacre in U.S. history. Descendants of massacred indigenous ancestors took exception to that designation. And she mentions the shooter himself was a child of colonial war, the U.S. war in Korea. So we, you know, all these things where we, a lot of times these some of these reports in the media, the whack people doing these things, that whether they're on medication or whether, you know, they were Vietnam vets, which isn't to say how much that's typical of Vietnam vets, but that this, the training and this lineage of the military, and is certainly a huge issue. So wrapping up this chapter, meditating on the five major U.S. wars since World War II, in Korea, Vietnam, Iraq 1991, Afghanistan, and Iraq 2003, with flashes of historical memory of Jamestown, the Ohio Valley, and Wounded Knee, brings us to the essence of U.S. history. A red thread of blood connects the first white settlement in North America with today and the future. As military historian John Grenier puts it, U.S. people are taught that their military culture does not approve of or encourage targeting and killing civilians, and know little or nothing about the nearly three centuries of warfare before and after the founding of the U.S. that reduced the indigenous people of the continent to a few reservations by burning their towns and fields and killing civilians, driving the refugees out step by step across the country, the continent. Violence directed systematically against non-combatants through irregular means from the start has been a central part of Americans' way of war. So one of the reasons I quote like the term empire is it helps to connect, it connects the historical dots as this book is doing, and helps to show where stuff is coming from and where you can see where a lot of it is headed towards, and along those lines, and why we are living in such a significant age. Not that every age isn't significant, but just the time of potential for swaying things, as, for example, the popularity of Sanders and even Trump shows a sense of disgruntlement with the status quo system, which is more of the Clinton dynasty. And yet, even amongst that, the lack of the wider picture, again, with, to simplify it, the imperialism and the native peoples, but I think those really kind of get to the gist of that, and the overlooking of that still has me, you know, pondering and wondering what is going on with the U.S. as a country, and the signs of, you know, more people protesting, and natives and non-natives working together are definitely the positive signs, and greater global consciousness about Mother Earth and devastation of, you know, fossil fuels and those extractive energy systems. All this stuff is coming to the fore, and even beyond that, it's not just the energy systems, but the you know, holistically, the mind frame and the spiritual angle, because we can get new energy systems, but still the whole awareness of and relating with, for example, sacred sites has to be in the mix. So thank you again for listening, and let's see, we're up to, so yeah, that chapter called The Ghost Dance Prophecy, just having to backtrack to another chapter, Pilgrim's Journey to Hear His Message, the Paiute Holy Man Wovoka, and to receive directions on how to perform the ghost dance which promised to restore the indigenous world as it was before colonialism, making the invaders disappear and the buffalo return. So that's some of the prophecy, I guess that's some of the prophecy and how that plays out. I was reading about the Andean peoples, and you know, that is the blend of the times we're in, where it's not just going back to how it was, you can't do that, but there has to be some level of respect for the past, and with that going forward. So it's a blend, it's, you know, it's an old ancient tried and true traditions blending with the here and now, and that's what really in the moment we're all learning as we do it. So that's my suggestion, or at least what's coming to my mind right now as that's being said, is that one of the key things for here and the future is how do we intertwine these ancient traditions and knowledges and wisdoms, wisenesses and whatever you call it, and that sort of in the moment Zen attention to how do we take that and be in the moment now and take the information we have about what's going on and how do we use that, intertwine that to, you know, make positive change and all get along better. So with that pondering, I wish you well and thank you for listening and have a good one. And we'll go out with a song from an album called Ghost Dance Songs by the Red Shadow Singers. And finding this on, you guessed it, YouTube. And this one's called Creator.